I have this picture in my mind of meetings like this, when all the subjects have been gathered together and those who choose the speakers sit down and look at the subjects and they say, well, who's someone that has experience in this area? So I have to say to begin with that the reports of my death are greatly exaggerated. Not very original, but it seemed to fit. A few years ago, we went to South Dakota. We were going to see the Black Hills and, of course, Mount Rushmore, various other things that were there. I'd heard of the Badlands, but I'd never seen them. I suppose I had probably seen some pictures of them. I don't know. But that's the first thing that we went to see when we got there, and I was simply overwhelmed by what we saw. It was nothing like I expected. And it's probably the thing, the memory that sticks with me the most throughout that trip, although I remember all of the other things. Just that stuck out because I just had no concept of what it was. So as we look at the subject of after death, then what, we don't know exactly what we're looking at, do we? We get some hints, and I tried to think of something that might help me at least and relate to this. And so I thought of those in the Old Testament, and in particular the Jews, as they anticipated the Messiah's kingdom. And they did have a number of things to help them to know what it was. And I'm convinced at the time that Christ came, they knew that this was the time for the Messiah. But yet there's no way that they could have known exactly what it was going to be. And as Paul mentioned in 1 Corinthians 13, they were looking through a glass darkly or obscurely. They had hints and ideas and some of what it was going to be, but to say that they actually knew what it was going to be, I think would be a stretch. So if we wouldn't expect the Jews to understand the fullness of the Messiah's kingdom until it came, neither should we expect to understand the world is yet to come until we actually see it. As a matter of fact, it probably is a great consolation to us that as we look back and we see, we can see the Lord's kingdom, see what it is, see how it unfolded, and see what it was, and it was so much greater than the imagination of the Jews or anyone else. And this should be something that's great consolation to us, and I'm convinced that the eternal kingdom is going to be even so much more so that for us to even talk about it is somewhat difficult. We've heard of people who have had what are called near-death experiences. We talk about a person's life passing before their eyes. People who have said they've seen light at the end of the tunnel, and yet others who speak of having hovered over their own body and looking down upon those. I'm really not going to speak to those. I can't. I really can't relate to those things. I'm not going to speak of them either pro or con. I can only speak to you of my own experience. I've been under anesthesia 3 times and probably isn't anything at all like being near death. There's others that can speak to that more clearly than I can. I have had one experience in my life, at least one experience in my life, where I had to contemplate, is this where I'm going to die? Is this how I'm going to die? And there was nothing that passed before my eyes. There was nothing that passed through my mind. But you have to understand that I'm not a very creative person, and that I don't spend a lot of time imagining. And I know others are much better at that, so I can't relate to that in that way. The questions about the eternal have been around for a long time. In Luke, the 20th chapter, when the Sadducees came to Jesus, they were not looking for something that would tell them about the life that was to come because they didn't believe in the resurrection. What they were really looking for was to try to stump Jesus concerning the resurrection. So they asked the question. There was a woman who had 7 husbands. Now, in the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? But Jesus did answer them with a question that at least related to the eternal. He said that in the resurrection, they will neither be marrying nor giving in marriage. Children of this world They neither marry nor are given in marriage, but they that shall be counted worthy to obtain the world and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage, nor can they die anymore. So this, even though this wasn't the question that the Sadducees asked him, I believe that this type of question existed in the days of Jesus. In doing some research for this particular lesson, I looked back through some of the books that I had, and I read a couple of different articles, one which was written in 1863 and the other in 1865, which, of course, would have been at the time of the Civil War and the end of Abraham Lincoln's presidency. And it was rather interesting to look that they were asking the very same questions that was in the letter that I received. And so, and I believe that probably the same questions have been asked ever since man has had any indication of eternity. I believe those same questions are going to go ahead and continue to be asked. But we're going to look at what we do have today and remembering some of the things that, the Lord has told us. In 1 Corinthians 15, 51, I want to mention, in 1 Corinthians 15, 51, where Paul, in that 15th chapter, is speaking concerning the physical body and the spiritual body. In the 51st verse, he says, "Behold, I tell you a mystery." You know, how this physical body is going to change into to this spiritual. And that's really difficult for us to understand. He says, "We shall not all sleep or die, but we shall all be changed." It's really difficult for us to relate to that, isn't it? That the fleshly, that there is a fleshly body and that there is a spiritual body. 1 Corinthians 15, 55, or rather 35, Paul anticipates questions that were going to be asked concerning this spiritual body and the physical body. In the 35th verse, he says, asks the question, the rhetorical question, "How are the dead raised? With what body do they come?" And then he goes on to answer this question to some degree. In the 44th verse, he says, "There is a natural body, and there is a spiritual body." And in verse 49, he said, "As we have borne the image of the man of dust," meaning Adam, "we all shall also bear the image of the heavenly man." So we do have a few clues, at least, in Scripture that give us some indication of what the eternal will be like. In answer to the Sadducees, as the same story that we mentioned in Luke 20, in Matthew 22 and 30, Jesus says, "In the resurrection, they will be like the angels in heaven." Well, this conjures up some thoughts in our minds also. We know that the angels are spirits. We know, as we learn from 1 Corinthians, or rather Hebrews, the first chapter and the 14th verse, that he says the angels, he refers to them as being ministering spirits. So I believe he mentioned, what he indicates there is being like the angels, we will be in that spiritual body. I think we understand this very clearly. In 1 John, the third chapter and the second verse, John reveals it to us this way: "Beloved, now we are the children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." We know what a physical body looks like. We know a lot about the physical body. But what does a spiritual body look like? It's just really hard to even imagine that, isn't it? And yet we know, it clearly points out to us that the body will exist, but it will be a spiritual body. It has not yet been revealed. And as far as I know, since there's been no more scripture revealed unto us since the time that John spoke this, nothing else has been revealed about what we will look like. We don't know yet what we'll look like, but we'll be like him. And that ought to be good enough, shouldn't it? That ought to be something wonderful. A few questions that always come up, and we're going to take a look at them this morning. Will we recognize one another in eternity? Well, the difficulty comes in, we're trying to describe one world with the words of another world. we're looking through that glass obscurely or darkly, and trying to take the words that we know and describe a world that we know nothing about. And I believe that the knowledge, the understanding of the eternal world is going to be so much greater than even the wisest, smartest man, all the knowledge that ever existed on the face of the earth. Look at John in revealing, when Revelation was revealed to him. He had to speak in words that we would understand, and yet none of us have any difficulty realizing that he's speaking in the words that we know, and that heaven's going to be so much greater than what that description will be in the book of Revelation. The Bible nowhere formally raises the question of future recognition, neither consequently does it anywhere formally answer it. But we do have some inferences. I'd like to go back to 1 Samuel, the 28th chapter. Samuel had died, and the Philistines were coming up against Israel, and Saul, the king, had looked out and had seen them advancing, and he became quite concerned. He assembled his armies, and then, after the armies were assembled, he looked out at the Philistines, and it says that he was afraid. He saw something that he wasn't sure that they could overcome, and so he goes to the Lord and asks him for advice, but the Lord didn't answer him. So in his excitement, even though he had declared that no one was to go to seek those who could raise the dead through trances or whatever it might be, he himself disguised himself and went to what is spoken of as a witch, the witch of Endor, and asked her to bring up someone. And she said, "Who shall I bring up?" And he said, "Samuel." And when she did whatever she did, Samuel came up. And she was shocked. And Saul says, "What does he look like?" He says, "Well, it's an old man dressed in a robe and so forth." I tend to think that she saw him in much the same fashion, at least, as what he was on the earth. And then we find that Saul and Samuel begin to have a discussion. So they were able to, in some way, and in some form at least, to communicate. In Matthew 17, at the Mount of Transfiguration, we find Peter, James, and John coming to the mountain. And they saw Moses and Elijah, and we don't read of any formal introduction. It just seems that Peter, James, and John knew who they were. They recognized them. And as Jesus talked with them and spoke to them, they recognized who they were. So certainly they were recognizable. In Luke, the 16th chapter, verses 27 and 28, which is a story familiar to all of us, the rich man and Lazarus. And we find that as the rich man looked up, he saw Abraham. And he knew it was Abraham. And he talked with Abraham. There was communication that existed there. And not only that, but Abraham responded. In Luke chapter 23, verses 42 and 43, which is Jesus as he was on the cross and was between the two thieves. And the one thief said, "Remember me when we come into paradise, or when your kingdom comes." And Jesus says, "This day thou shalt be with me in paradise." Why did he even say that if in paradise the thief would have not recognized Jesus, would have not known where he was? There had to be some recognition there, didn't there? In John chapter 14, verses 2 and 3, as Jesus spoke to the disciples, he said, "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also." It seems clear that Jesus would recognize them at that time, and that they would recognize him. They would know the place that they were in. So there must be some type of memory that exists there. And I'm not going to try to define the extent of that, because I believe for me to do so would be foolish. Will this recognition be only in heaven? What about a waiting place? That there's a place where the spirits of man goes after this earth life is quite clear. That there are separate places for both the righteous and the wicked. This is called Hades, and the word Hades simply means unseen. So when we're relating that word, we're not talking about hell, but we're talking about both places where the dead go. It's just called that which is unseen, meaning unseen to the human eye. Are these places separate from heaven and hell? Well, we've already established, hopefully at least, that consciousness and recognition exist. But is there a waiting place? I believe to suggest that there is a waiting place would suggest that there is a continuation of time in some form. And I really don't know how to wrap my mind around that. But from death until judgment, if there is indeed a waiting place, there is, how do we quantify, how do we speak of that time? How does it exist? I don't say that it doesn't exist, I just don't know how to express it. If Adam and Eve were saved, and I guess we have no reason really to believe they were not, what have they been doing for the last 6,000 years? What's going on there? Is there some purpose in all that's happening at that time? Let me say this. In Exodus, the 3rd chapter and the 6th verse, when Moses was at the burning bush, and you remember most of the story, I don't know whether you would remember this part of the story or not. It's not one that we talk about a great deal. But there, God said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now remember that. And Matthew 22:30-32, this is again going back to the Jesus and the Sadducees when they ask him the question, is there, you know, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? He says, you should already know. In other words, their scriptures gave them some indication of what was to come. And then he repeats what God said to Moses. God is not the God of God. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is not a God of the dead, but of the living. He spoke of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as if those people, should they see them in the eternal kingdom, would recognize them. That whoever was in that kingdom would recognize who they are. God always speaks of those in eternity in the present tense. That's the only tense that exists in eternity. We have so much difficulty in understanding all of this because our lives are totally framed by time. And to be able to understand what eternity is like, we have to somehow get that out of our mind, and that's impossible. We can't do that. So sometimes we create things that structure them in such a way that we can understand it in our language. It seems even the spirits of the unrighteous do not die a death of decay or extinction, but one of continual eternal torment, a wishing for death, but never receiving it. I want to look at another example. We go to 2 Corinthians, the 12th chapter, verses 1 through 4. You recognize this as the writings of Paul, and I want to read the first four verses to you. I'm sure you'll recognize this once I read it. It is doubtless not profitable for me to boast. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago, whether in the body I do not know, or whether out of the body I do not know, God knows. Such a one that was caught up to the third heaven. And I know such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows how he was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words which it is not lawful for a man to utter. Let's not make more out of this than what it is, but let's try to find everything that is there. When Paul spoke of coming to visions and revelations, at least the understanding that I get of in my word search on this is Visions are a coming into view, a revealing of oneself. Revelations, a revealing of things before unknown, a disclosure of truth. So I believe what Paul is saying, I'm going to tell you something that happened, and I believe that Paul is likely talking about himself. I'm going to tell you something I have never revealed before, and this is a true story. He says, I knew a man, not heard of, not one that someone had told him about, but someone whom he had personal knowledge of. And I think many of us have wondered a number of times if indeed this is Paul, if he was talking about the time at Lystra in Acts the 14th chapter, in the 19th verse where he was stoned and thrown out of the city and left for dead. But anyway, Paul says, I have some personal knowledge of what I'm talking about. Whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. We would just say, I don't know whether I was dead or alive. There's a fine line there somewhere. And Paul is saying, I was on that line. But I think we have something, the most insightful thing that Paul says in all of this, but he says, God knows. Whether I was dead or alive, I don't know, but God knows. Which gives us some understanding of a little more understanding of God and his greatness. But he said, I was caught up into the third heaven. Caught up, snatched away. It's used in much the same way that when Philip spoke to the Ethiopian, and when he was through, we remember it says he was caught away and he was found at Azotus. It's also used in 1 Thessalonians, the 4th chapter, and the 17th verse, where he's talking about the coming of the Lord back to earth again. And he said, those that are alive that would not die. And he says, we who are alive and remain shall be caught up. And he goes on from there. So Paul, in his revealing to us of what this incident was, it was something where he was taken away, snatched away, at least for a period of time. And where was he taken? He was taken to the third heaven. And some of your translations, I think, read paradise, which is, I think, correct. To give you just a little bit of a idea of how some things come into existence when we're talking about things that we don't know what we're talking about. To the Persians, paradise was a hunting ground, shady and well-watered, in which wild animals were kept for the hunt. And so from this comes probably sometimes we've talked about someone had died, we say they went to the happy hunting ground. We get these phrases which help us to relate. This is a good example of how we can only describe things in our own words. But Paul saw an upper region in the heavens. Three times in the New Testament, excuse me, that the word paradise is used. The first time was when Jesus was on the cross and he said to the thief, this day thou shalt be with me in paradise. The second is this example of Paul that we're talking about, where he said he was caught up to the third heaven, which is described as paradise. The third is found in Revelation, the 2nd chapter and the 7th verse, to the letter to the Ephesians. And he says, to him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. The tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. So we're talking about the abode of God and heavenly beings to which the saved have been taken. And he said, I heard unspeakable or inexpressible words. In other words, he says, there are no human words to describe what was seen. And not only that, he was forbidden or was not allowed to speak them. And what my feeling, at least my concept of what he is saying, is that I'm not even allowed to try to put in the language of the world what I saw, because of the injustice that it would have done. It would have served no purpose, and it probably maybe would have even confused things even more. So he said, it's not lawful for me to utter. Paul was not even allowed to try. So we still haven't answered the question, is there a waiting place? What's going on there? What's going on in the waiting place? Is this where Lazarus and the rich man are? Are they just in some kind of a holding pattern? Or, you know, what are they doing? Well, I believe that the thought of a waiting place, and really the way Jesus says, and other places where reference has been made with various words, have given rise to the doctrine in some places of what is called soul sleeping. This would, again, if there is such a thing as soul sleeping, which is, means the soul after you die, your soul goes someplace and it's like non-existent or in unconscious or whatever until the judgment, and then it is raised up again. Well, if this is the case, then again, we're trying to express some type of a time frame. I don't say it doesn't exist. I just don't know how to frame that. So the term sleep or sleeping as relates to death in the Scripture is many times used metaphorically, as we sometimes do. Sometimes we'll talk about a person who dies and we'll say they just went to sleep. Well, we know that they didn't just go to sleep, they died. But this is our way of expressing that. We find that at other times it's the result of the translator's use of the words instead of died. And why they chose to use the word sleep or sleeping, I don't know. I can't read their minds. But it was used as a metaphor when Jesus was speaking of Lazarus. And the people came to him and they said, Lazarus has died. And Jesus said, no, he's just sleeping. Oh, they misunderstood Jesus. Because he seems to be indicating that Lazarus is dead, but only for a while, only for a short while. And then they said, well, if he's just sleeping, if he's just taking a nap, he'd been sick after all. And, you know, after we've been sick, what's good for you? He's just resting. That's good. And then Jesus had to plainly say, no, Lazarus has died. So, you know, we need to look at how the word sleep and sleeping are used. And you don't hear too much about soul sleeping, but it does exist, and so you need to be aware of that. Is there a waiting place? I'm going to tell you that I'm just not smart enough to draw the lines beyond this earth life. I know some of the indications that we have and some of the word studies that we can do. But I think when we come to the end of those studies, we are still quite inept at describing what God has in store. And to do so probably is misleading. And just think about, you know, how many times have we sat in our congregations and criticized the Jews for not understanding the kingdom of Christ when it came? And then we want to describe a kingdom that we can't see using the terms that exist here. And that makes it extremely different. We know only how to frame things by time. There have been opportunities for those who are experiencing eternity to describe their experience when they came back, but they didn't. Why didn't, when Moses and Elijah was on the mount with Jesus in transfiguration, why didn't they say to Peter, James, and John, you guys are not going to believe what this is like? And go on giving a description to Peter, James, and John of what eternity's like. What about Lazarus, the brother of Mary and Martha, when he was raised from the dead? He'd been dead for 4 days. Why didn't he express to the people, at least we don't have anything recorded, where he spoke at all about that experience? What about those who came out of the graves at Christ's resurrection? Can't you just imagine in today's world, if something like this happened, and you have to really let your imagination run wild if you're going to do this, but just think of the book deals, the movies, all of the different things. It's ridiculous for us to think in those terms. When Christ already knew what heaven was like when he came to the earth. but he only gave us what we could understand. The same was true after he was resurrected. He never spoke to his disciples about what it was like in paradise. Paul wasn't allowed to speak. Why wasn't John able to tell us what the real new heaven and new earth look like? We know that that description does not express what's going to be there. If it is, we would be disappointed. And I don't think we're going to be disappointed. Our knowledge and understanding is intended to help us navigate this earth life. We have been given a taste of eternity, but we will never understand it in its fullness until we are invited to the feast. Let's draw some conclusions, if we can. So what do we know? That eternity, in its reality, is in many ways a mystery to us. We've been given some, I hate to even call them hints, but at least some thoughts as to what it will be like, and that this earthly body will be raised a spiritual body, and that the spirit never dies. It seems obvious that there is some type of recognition in eternity, but it seems to be based not on what we look like, but on who we are. In all the instances that we see, we doesn't mean there weren't introductions, but we never see that, but it was just almost instantly. Can you imagine someone recognizing you because of who you are, not because of the body that you live in, but because of who you are? And it seems to me that in eternity, that's the way we will know one another, who we are. Our looks, physical looks are not going to matter. All of these things that we put so much emphasis on here are not going to matter. They have no relevance to eternity. The fleshly desires and passions are not a part of the eternal. Now, I didn't say there wouldn't be any desires and passions in eternity, because I remember many times when God pleaded with his people, and that's very passionate pleas. But there's something that, again, that we can't imagine. It's so much better than what we have here. What about a waiting place? Well, I simply do not know how to frame that and put it into context of everything. My mind is just not capable of doing that. The departed apparently have no direct influence over those in the flesh. And in some ways, I think this is probably disappointing to people. But when we feel the presence of loved ones or experience a familiar situation, we shouldn't be surprised. After all, we knew them well, and we find comfort in their memory and in the things that we knew and did with them. Beyond that, we don't know. It's what God chooses. The only thing I can tell you for certain about the world to come, that eternal world, is that it will be worth waiting for. Remember in Matthew, the 7th chapter, it doesn't relate to eternity, but where it mentions that God knows how to give good gifts. What did God say after each day of creation? It is good. What did he say after the 6th? It is very good. That's the way God does things, and it's worth waiting for. Anytime speculating about the future would probably be better spent in preparing for the future. Wait on God. He knows what he's doing.